Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are the Beatle Brains of Ireland, and we host Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles.
We might look at Beatles albums, we might tell you what books you need to be taking on holiday. We've done an episode from Abbey Road Studios, and we do live shows.
We've also had guests on our podcast, like Beatles biographer Mark Lewison and singer-songwriter Robin Hitchcock. Search for Nothing Is Real on Acast, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Available 8 days a week.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin in front of an audience. My goodness. And we are here. They weren't asked to do that. We are here as part of the Dublin Beatles Festival, which is an annual celebration here in the capital of all things fab. The inaugural festival was in 2013 to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' sole Dublin concert at the Adelphi Theatre on the 7th of November 1963. And the site of the Adelphi is a short stroll from where we are today in Bridie's Bar in Marlborough Street in Dublin. But obviously, don't look for the Adelphi. It's not there anymore, although your car is parked there today.
It is,
which is quite useful. And we want to thank Steve Kennedy for, as usual, putting together a fantastic festival and for asking us along to do this fantastic thing. Now, the plan today is that myself and Stephen are doing what's known as a reverse Beatles, because we've done our in-studios experiments, and now we're going to do live shows and leave the studio behind. And we're in front of a crowd of maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people, I think, Stephen. That's what it looks like to me. And we're going to answer the pertinent question of our time: who is better, Paul McCartney or George Harrison? Now, assuming you're familiar with the Nothing Is Real canon, it'll come as no surprise that I'm standing for Paul McCartney, and standing for George Harrison is...
Stephen,
yes. And we've tried to figure out the best way of doing this, and we're going to try and address Paul versus George under 6 different headings, and we're going to throw some ideas and opinions back and forth, and at the end we'll see how this all works out. If you feel the need to voice your opinion through cheers or boos, feel free to do so, and we'll do a quick voice poll maybe as we go along during the topics to see how people feel about each individual heading. So try and leave your personal preferences at the door and listen to the nuanced, intricate arguments of myself and Stephen. And I'm going to put in a personal disclaimer here, which is that if I say anything today personally, me, Jason, as that seems very anti-George or seems very mean, I'm just being, you know, the pantomime villain, the wrestling heel. I obviously love George very much, and I love the Beatles very much. Do you want to say anything nice about Paul before we start?
No.
Brand. Fine. So, and one final thing, please, no wagering. Okay, let's get started. We've got our comedy bell for round one. And we're going to talk about, first of all, Paul and George as Beatles within the Beatles themselves. Because I'm going to start by saying I think that Paul is the Beatliest Beatle who ever Beatled, and he's still a Beatle today. He still thinks he's a Beatle.
I think that's the trouble.
Oh, okay. Why is that the trouble?
I think my issue with Paul is he's never stopped being a Beatle. And I think as the years go by, he thinks he is the Beatles, and he was the Beatles. And you know, I've no issue with Paul as a songwriter. I think he's a great songwriter. I think he's a great musician. But there are elements of his character where, you know, he's since John Lennon died in particular, since George Harrison died, he's consistently tried to rewrite the authorized history of the band to emphasize his role. Obviously, very important role, but he's sidelining other members of the band. So suddenly he's the avant-garde one. He's the curator. He's dyeing his hair and putting on his Shea Stadium jacket. And he's just becoming the Beatles. And one of the things, and partly, you know, because he has such a natural gift, musical flair, there isn't the development in his career, in his songwriting, in his musicianship that perhaps you get from George or John or, you know, arguably even Ringo.
Well, hold on a second now.
Sorry, I have to ring a bell.
Not quite yet. But then, do you think the opposite is true? That George, I mean, my problem with George is that George always strikes me as the only Beatle who doesn't like the Beatles. And as the Beatles goes on, you know, he sort of sets himself up in opposition to the Beatles. And after the Beatles, and particularly after, you know, you talk about Paul taking over one mantle when John died. I think when John died, George took over this mantle where he says, oh, I'm going to be the bullshit detector and I'm going to be the guy who's, you know, sticks it to the Beatles as an entity. And I don't think John would have done that if he'd lived. And I kind of get this thing that, you know, it kind of suits him to rub up against the Beatles.
No, I think the progression for George is he was absolutely 100% committed to the band. So in the early days, the sequence, John brings in Paul, Paul brings in George, George pushes for Ringo. George is absolutely 100% committed to the band. Where I think the luster starts to fade slightly for George is once they start the world tours after that first world tour, and he suddenly realizes you're playing to screaming crowds, they can't hear you, they're not getting any better as musicians. And that's something that you hear in those interviews in 65 and 66 from George, is we're not getting any better, we're just doing the same thing, we're just trotting this out. And he's instrumental in the calling a halt to touring. So I think in one sense, I think Paul would probably have been quite happy just being in the Beatles and touring and being in the Beatles and touring a little bit more and releasing records. But everyone else is growing out of the Beatles, or certainly out of what the public perception of the band was at that stage. You know, they're all not in little jackets and they're touring, and that's great. But time goes on. Paul, I think, would be quite happy to have preserved that sort of in aspect for all time.
You could argue he's doing a version
of
it today.
And arguably that's what he's I think that's my argument.
But if you, I'm just thinking there's this, I think it's a Douglas Adams analogy where Puddles, you know, the Puddle thinks he's perfect for the world because he fits into it. And Paul might think he's perfect for the world.
I think of him as a puddle.
Paul thinks he's perfect for the Beatles because he seemed to enjoy all of that, which is kind of what you're saying. But then doesn't George, you could argue that kind of from summer 67 to summer 68, there's a very much a George tilt into how the Beatles progress. Yeah. And he sort of takes over, not necessarily the leadership of the band, but a sort of, you know, particularly through the mysticism.
Yeah, I think come 66, 67, there's something very strange happens within the band. So suddenly George is setting an agenda or setting a tone. That's because there's the Indian music influence, and that's creeping into the Beatles music. He's off doing a soundtrack, and then also you've got Meditation and the Maharishi, and the others are kind of suddenly taking a bit of a lead from him. And this corresponds with Lennon taking a lot of acid, so he's no longer functioning perhaps in that role. And suddenly George finds himself where he has genuine influence over the sound of the band and the direction they're going in. And one of the telling things, I think, is if you think what happened slightly later in the band, where arguably Paul assumes that role, late 68, 69, what does Paul do with that when he's in that role?
He starts
telling everybody what to do. He starts arranging the songs. He starts, oh, you play this and you play that. What does George do?
George shuts down.
His 67 is not full of George songs or him saying, you must do this or you must do that. He's taking them in a direction, you know, it's a pretentious thing to say, but sort of philosophically, he's moving them in a particular direction. I think if the band hadn't followed him in that direction, I don't think he'd have been too concerned. But he comes up with Within You Without You, which is a completely standalone track. And for my money, I would say this, this is the single most impressive achievement from that year of 67. You've got All You Need Is Love, you've got A Day in the Life.
You've got Lovely Rita, yeah.
You've got Lovely Rita, well, yeah. but this is, Within You Without You is arguably the most spectacular thing that happens up to this point. We'll come on to this maybe when we're talking about songwriting.
Well, but when George kind of has that sort of, let's call it a spiritual stewardship of the band.
I like your thinking. That,
fair enough. I don't know, does he enjoy that, or does he realize that he's doing that, or does he think,
I think so. I think so, because I think he is very conscious of it.
Okay.
Because if you look at, after the sort of disillusionment in Rishikesh in 1968, he comes up with the song Not Guilty, which contains the line, don't blame me, for leading you astray and the road to Mandalay. This is clearly, we talked about this on a previous episode about songs where the Beatles wrote songs about each other. I think this is him very explicitly saying, I only want what I can get. I don't want to upset the apple cart. Don't blame me for this, So that song is all about that.
So then experience. What about George as a Beatle after 1970? Because he's, he tends to use the leverage of being a Beatle to enjoy his life, you could say. But he tends to, does he not kind of knock it down a bit or be a bit?
Well, I don't know. He's got, post 1970, he's enjoying the money. He's got a big house. He's got fast cars. He's got the trappings of a rock star. But the one thing I would say musically is 1970, post the split, the one who steps furthest away from the Beatles is George in terms of the sound of All Things Must Pass. If you look at the first McCartney album, even Ram, let's gloss over Wildlife.
But it's
if you look at the McCartney, listen to the McCartney album, listen to Ram, listen to Plastic Ono Band has this reputation as this incredibly raw sounding album, but it's got God, it's got Love, it's got little Hold On, it's got little songs. It's still quite Beatley sound. All Things Must Pass doesn't sound like anything the Beatles ever recorded. Nothing.
Yeah.
And arguably, people have been in the last month or two making the case that, Abbey Road is the first rock album of the 1970s, and this sets the template. I think it's the last album of the 60s. The first album that sets the template is All Things Must Pass. And he absolutely is stepping away. He's not trading on the Beatles sound. My Sweet Lord.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to the solo careers in a second. But as a Beatle, though, like in the 90s for, say, the Anthology.
Yeah.
Do you think he was as happy about the Anthology as Paul? Was anybody happy about the Anthology at all?
No, I don't think. I mean, I don't think he's... I don't think George would have participate. I don't think we would have Anthology if he hadn't suffered financial problems with his business manager.
Every cloud, eh?
Every cloud nine.
All right. So, okay.
So,
as a Beatle, though, so in closing, the Beatliest Beatle who
finished.
Ever Beatled.
I have no argument with your statement that Paul is the Beatliest Beatle who ever Beatled.
I wrote that down.
Yeah. I have no, my argument is I don't think that's a good thing.
Okay.
I think George and the others in particular, they enjoyed being Beatles up to a point, and then it became a straitjacket. And they all sort of went off in different directions, including Paul, pretended to write a soundtrack album, that type of thing. But Paul just wanted to get back into the straitjacket. He's the only person in the world ever that wanted to get back into the straitjacket. The others took what they had. They used it. George used it to launch a solo career. John did that. They used it to do good things. They made use of it. Coming back to Anthology, I don't think George would have done it. I think Cloud Nine shows him maybe coming to terms with having been a Beatle and what it meant. But no, you can. Anthology is a compromise. Everyone is doing it for their own reasons. I think Paul, in order to be a Beatle once again, yeah, you know, he's desperate to write songs with George at that point to get back.
Well, George famously said, "Was it George said? It's funny how Paul wants to write songs with me now." What was the that quote?
Yeah. So he Paul wants to be a Beatle again. Yeah. George, I think, is doing it for the money. Let's be honest. Yep. Ringo just wants everybody to be friends.
Yeah, know? Ringo. better than Paul and George.
Yeah.
Ringo, possibly.
Yeah, that's next year's debate.
okay, so maybe a quick yay or nay from the crowd. All those in favour of the best Beatle as a Beatle. All those in favour of George, say George.
George.
All those in favour of Paul, say Paul.
Paul.
I think the Paul's on that one. Round one to Paul. Round two.
I'm leaving at this point. I can see where this is going.
Yeah, I know. Throwing it to the mob. Round two, we're going to put down as songwriting.
Yeah. I've read your introduction here.
My introduction here.
not a hint of hyperbole.
Scientists believe that they've dated the birth of the universe to 13.8 billion years ago, and the first humans appeared between 5 to 7 million years ago. Through all of that time, one man is, by any metric imaginable, the most successful songwriter of all time, Paul McCartney. Whether it's records sold, radio plays, cover versions, or money earned, Macca is the greatest songwriter in the known observable universe. Stephen?
Yeah, I can't argue with that. I absolutely can't argue with that. I think if you're going to go by chart success, if you're going to go by money accumulated,
yes,
then I think Paul definitely the winner.
Okay. You're not going to give up like that, are you?
Do you want to ring the bell?
No, I want to, you know.
Okay.
There are other arguments.
There's nothing in your elaborately scripted introduction that I can argue with. But in terms of songwriting, I think is within the Beatles is fascinating.
Yes.
Someone should write a book
about the Beatles.
About the Beatles. Someone should write a book about the Beatles.
I think so.
Yeah. Songwriting, if you go right back to the early days of the band, I mean Quarrymen days, the split between the three vocalists is pretty much even. So if you look at the Decca tape, you look at the BBC tapes, John, Paul, George, they're all getting pretty much equal mic time. There are two songs from the early days of the Beatles, In Spite of All the Danger, mm-hmm. which is a McCartney Harrison credit, and Cry for a Shadow, which is a Lennon Harrison credit. So far, so good. What happens?
It was going so well.
It was going so well.
Yeah.
What happens just before they go into the studio for their Parlophone audition, if it is an audition, is Paul gets in. John in a room on his own and says, "This songwriting thing, should we cut George in? Should we have a three-way split on the songwriting?" And they decide, "No. What we're going to do is we're just going to carve up the songwriting." So regardless of who contributes what, they agree it's going to be Lennon McCartney, and that's regardless of whether John contributes to a Paul song, Paul contributes to a John song, or whether George contributes anything to either. Mm. And I think if you go right back and follow that through, that's the little seed that starts to drive the wedge, that as they become successful, as the songwriting royalties start coming in, and it's apparent that John and Paul are getting rich, that's the tiny seed. And it all starts there, where Paul takes John to one side and says, "You and me, let's carve this up."
Why did he do that?
Money.
Do you think?
Money.
Yeah.
I think at this point, they suddenly realize that there's money. That Paul makes some reference to at this point, we thought songs were just in the air. They were just, they didn't exist. You couldn't see them. You couldn't touch them. How did you make money out of this? But by this stage, Epstein is explaining to them, this is how it works. Ardmore and Beechwood, the publishing company, are saying, yes, these are the songs and we can make money. And they suddenly realize this is, and for Paul back then and ever since, it's about the money.
But you could argue that there was,
I'm getting the laughs.
But you could argue that even before they get into Abbey Road in 62, you know, there is form of Paul and John writing together, nose to nose, face to face, which hadn't really happened with George. I know he has those credits, but they're almost credits. From part of them are kind of almost like arranging credits, you could say that they're we've talked about this before about how bands decide what writing is and isn't, you know. And it's interesting that in the kind of the wave after the Beatles, you have bands like U2 and REM who decide, you know, we are not going to argue, it's going to be all of us on the writing credits. And Peter Buck famously in REM's, you know, said day one that's what they were going to do, and you could argue that that leads to a different kind of creativity and a different kind of longevity. Whereas Lennon McCartney decided that 50% of the band would be tied up in writing. And I suppose it's, you know, does writing a guitar part mean you've written a song? And some bands say yes and some bands say no.
Well, I mean, certainly that was Paul's take on In Spite of All the Danger. George came up with the guitar part. So Paul thinks, right, well, he did something here. I'll give him a credit. But it's the fact that it's a conscious decision. We're going to carve up the songwriting between the two of us. So certainly, you know, in the early days where they're sitting in Paul's house and they've got a notebook and they're writing down some chords and they're writing down some lyrics, that's a kind of joint process. But it becomes a much more sophisticated thing once they start recording. So I have 24 examples. I'm just going to run through. I have three examples. So, And I Love Her.
Mm-hmm.
The guitar part, the hook.
Yeah, the four notes.
That is George's arrangement. So they, if you listen to Anthology, they have a recorded an early version of that, an electric version, which is kind of a bit ho-hum. Mm-hmm. But it's George that says, what you need is a guitar part, a little riff to hang that this on. He produces that kind of Spanish guitar, and he produces that. In the Material World documentary, this is, Paul is saying, I mean, he actually says, you know, George really, I suppose, deserves a credit for that.
Mm.
Doesn't actually go back and posthumously give him a credit.
No.
But he acknowledges this is something. Eleanor Rigby.
Yep.
George comes up with the All the Lonely People.
Mm.
Look at All the Lonely People. That's George contributes to that. John doesn't contribute anything to the writing of that song.
Yeah.
But he gets a 50% credit. George gets nothing. But the most sort of egregious example of this is actually from John, and it's She Said, She Said, which is the last song they record for Revolver. It's a song where Lennon acknowledges that George contributed to that. McCartney doesn't contribute anything. George, I quote here, and he said, you know, I was at Lennon's John's house. He was struggling with a couple of tunes. He had loads of little bits and pieces, maybe three songs that were unfinished. We worked together. I helped him so that they became one finished song.
Mm.
When they came to record that, Paul has a massive argument, storms out of the studio, the argument being about the arrangement of the song because it's not being done the way Paul wants it to be done, even though he doesn't contribute. So it's recorded by the remaining three. And if you look at the credits, it's George playing the guitar parts, it's George playing the bass. So he writes the song with John and he records it. And I think I read somewhere, and I'm not sure where, I think it's maybe Steve Turner's book in 1966, that George actually felt that he was going to get a writing credit, that this was going to be a Harrison Lennon credit, and then that never happened, and that was a big turning point, a sort of disillusioning moment for him, and it sort of coincides. You're coming up to the end of 66. It coincides almost directly with the point where he's looking at Indian music. He's putting his guitar down. He doesn't really contribute much guitar to Pepper.
Well, in terms of evolution, from Don't Bother Me to Within You Without You is quite a change.
Yes. I mean, I think, well, again, if you want to talk about, as I absolutely quite happy to say, you know, Paul's facility and his musical gift is staggering. But it to the point where I think he kind of feels he doesn't need to work on that. He doesn't need to. So he's capable of writing P.S. I love you. I think if you probably pushed him in 63 or 64, he could probably have written Lovely Rita in 64 if he thought about it. But there's a sort of, with that facility, with that natural gift, there comes a sort of arrogance or a complacency where he's not really interested in, you know, he doesn't want to learn how to read music. He doesn't, where George is continually moving on from those sort of rockabilly, very sort of faltering, working out guitar parts. Then he's moving through from Don't Bother Me. And listening to the Sgt. Pepper box set, he's sitting down working with Indian classical musicians. He's writing lyrics based on Indian texts. In 4 years, that's a staggering progress. And that continues. And I think Ringo's drumming gets better. He's progressing. Yeah. Lennon is progressing, particularly in terms of lyrics and bringing his in his own right, Spaniard in the Works, his poems in. Paul, you know, I have this gift. Yeah. I don't need to.
He's so reliable, isn't he? That's what I think is great about him. It's true. You talk about Ringo there, but I mean, you think about, okay, you say the four notes of And I Love Her should have been a George composition, but you could say, well, Ringo.
I'm not saying that. Paul is saying that.
But Ringo, you could say he wrote the drum fills on A Day in the Life, and they're very distinctive. You know, there are drum patterns that you could say Tomorrow Never Knows. Should he have gotten a writing credit for that? Well, drum pattern. That's
maybe so.
Yeah, maybe so. There's the famous, I'm just remembering the famous story of Sting wrote the song Every Breath You Take.
Yeah.
Andy Summers did the guitar lick, but it's a Sting credit. And when it was sampled for that Puff Daddy song, help me out, someone, what's it called? No. I'll Be Watching You. Well done.
We have a young person in
there. Sting got the writing credit, and eventually, Stuart Copeland. Who was it? Summers. Sorry, Andy Summers. Andy Summers negotiated a royalty eventually because his guitar was used. But it just depends on the setup of the band.
It does, and I think it's very interesting to speculate what the consequences would have been if back in the day,
62,
they hadn't decided between them that they were going to carve this up between themselves. If they had said, well, you know, we'll just write the songs and whoever contributes will get a...
Yeah, because Lennon and McCartney, I know they eventually would say, well, I wrote a bit of that one, I wrote a bit of that one. But I don't really recall either of them ever saying, God damn it, I hated hitching my wagon to that other guy. Like, they never said that about each other.
No.
And they're still very true to the Lennon and McCartney ethos.
Or the McCartney-Lennon ethos.
Well,
Paul
yes.
has his way.
Okay, so in terms of songwriting, and it's interesting, one of the things with the recent Abbey Road reissue is this notion of, oh, hasn't George done well? Which I really dislike about.
Oh, yeah, well, if we're gonna, people have the box set and have read the foreword where Paul does it.
Yes,
very
yes.
lovely introduction, and then he said, "Oh, George, he really peaked with Abbey Road." So he's both dismissing everything that went before as being somehow less than the two songs George gets, and also everything that came after.
Sometimes I do wonder, does Paul know that he's doing that? And he's like rubbing his hands a little bit.
And then he goes on to say, you know, those two songs, they're Harrison classics. they're not classics.
They're Harrison.
By George's standards.
They're classic George.
And it's this, even to this day, this passive aggressive. And you say, does Paul know you think that every single word was not as scrupulously poured over as your script here today?
You know, interesting pop fact, if you listen closely to something, you can hear Paul play the bass.
Yeah. Mm.
You might
even more so on the recent remix.
It's much louder,
which Paul oversaw.
So in in terms of songwriting,
ring the bell now.
All those in favor of George, say George.
George.
All those in favor of Paul, say Paul.
Paul.
Really? Okay, George. All right, one each. Oh my God! Right. Okay.
Yes.
Now it's a fight.
Now we're
getting somewhere. Round three, musicianship. So who was the best musician? I'm going to play to the gallery here and say, was George the best guitarist in the world? He wasn't even the best guitarist in the Beatles. Oh, come on.
You've lost the room.
Well, you know. Yeah, musicianship. Surely isn't Paul great? He can play anything.
He can pick out a tune on almost anything.
Well, on the recent Wildlife reissue, we got Paul playing the trumpet as a hidden bonus track. Did anyone manage to make it to the end of the Wildlife third disc?
No.
Okay. Fine.
No one. Yeah. No, I you know, I'm repeating myself, but why not? Paul does have that musical gift. He does have that facility. My problem with Paul is he takes that gift for granted. And at best, he becomes complacent. At worst, he becomes arrogant. So, an example. The Abbey Road box set, the Sessions disc, there is a very good outtake of Oh Darling. You know, great song by Paul. And it's one of those rare examples late in the Beatles' career that is a real group ensemble performance, so that there's the four guys in the studio and they're playing this song. And if you listen to the outtake, it's great.
Yeah.
So they go on to record it. And then having recorded it, Paul comes in the next day, wipes George's guitar part and puts his own guitar part on it. But if you listen to the outtake, it's pretty much identical.
Yeah.
So he doesn't add anything to the part, and the group performance is fine, but Paul just got to do that. So he's doing that as early as, is it You Can't Do That, was the song on Help, where he comes in.
It's another girl. Sorry. Yeah.
Thank you. We have a fact checker in the audience. So he comes in and he wipes George's guitar part. This is the controlling factor. So there's this arrogance. Oh Darling is a great example of that. Brilliant group performance. Paul is the one at this stage that, you know, he's desperately trying to preserve the band. He's floating this idea, you know, we could actually get back in the clubs and we could do some live shows. And then as soon as they have a group performance, he comes in and completely undermines that.
Yeah.
And that's something that is consistent, you know, whether it's Henry McCulloch in Wings, whether it's Eric Stewart with Press, a lost classic. There is a podcast. Yeah. That's the podcast that I'll be arguing in favor of Paul. But it's the arrogance that comes with that facility. Plus, he never feels the need to really work on his gift, on his musicianship.
Yeah, I know you've said this to me before, that constantly ringing me up middle of the night. There's something very, I found myself about a week or two ago watching the Ed Sullivan shows. And when Paul does his, or when George does his solo on Till There Was You, which is obviously something he has meticulously worked on.
Yeah.
And it's utterly charming, note perfect, you know, the little finger action is just hypnotic. If you're a guitar player, that you can kind of see how he sat down and worked on his instrument and his craft and his tone changes throughout the career. Obviously.
And he's the one thing I think George doesn't get enough credit for is what he gives to the songs, the other people's songs, to Paul's songs, George. So Revolver, for example, George's
guitar solo in Taxman.
Well,
Paul McCartney.
Well, I'm getting there. I'm getting there. So, so what you've got in Revolver, there's the backwards guitar part. So if you read Jeff Emmerich's book, and Jeff Emmerich is no fan of George Harrison, he talks about George comes in, he spends hours on his own painstakingly working out what these guitar parts should be backwards, works with George Martin, and a lot of the credit for the sound of that is down to George. The Taxman guitar part, absolutely fantastic guitar part played by Paul. George has absolutely no problem across his career collaborating with other people. If there is someone that can play the part better, or someone whom he thinks is appropriate, whether that's I'll get Eric Clapton in to play because, you know, that's something I won't be able to do. He's quite happy to defer to other musicians. He's quite happy to work with other musicians. 1969, he goes on the road with Delaney and Bonnie. He's standing at the back. Delaney says, Dave Mason can't do the next few shows. Do you think you could learn how to play slide guitar? Yeah, I can do that. Very unassuming.
Yeah. And that has ramifications.
And that has ramifications. So in terms of musicianship, so Paul, George at this point, is constantly honing his craft. He does not have the same inherent musical flair, gift. That Paul has, but I don't think there are very few people that do. I mean, certainly not John, not Ringo, not George, but he is constantly working. So you think in 66, he basically, late 66, he virtually puts down the guitar and goes off and sits at Ravi Shankar's feet and is genuinely thinking, I could learn, I could be this fantastic sitar player. And when he realizes that that's not going to happen, that you have to study for decades, then he sort of comes back to the to the guitar. But he's constantly improving. And then you've got the slide guitar part that no one, it's almost inventing an entirely new way of playing slide guitar. It's not a Ry Cooder style, it's not a blues style. If you listen, there was a BBC radio documentary after he died, and Gary Moore, with whom he was very friendly, was trying to demonstrate how you would play this, and he said it's impossible. There's no one can play this. Even Belinda Carlisle recognized that he was unique.
That is a fantastic solo on Belinda Carlisle's "Leave a Light On."
Yeah.
By George. That is a super thing. It's any excuse to listen to Belinda Carlisle. Maybe though we're being a bit unfair to Paul, because we're kind of saying, "Hey, Paul,
the
multi instrumentalist, and isn't George a great guitarist?" Let's just focus on Paul as a bass player versus George as a guitarist. So, you know, if we take it instrument to instrument.
Yeah, look at these apples and look at these oranges. Yeah.
Surely we're undermining the whole point of this podcast if we're getting to that point. But, you know, I think you're absolutely right. I think George...
Ring the bell.
You can track his evolution as a guitarist. And, you know, the stuff on Abbey Road just sounds fantastic and meticulous. But Paul does have an evolution as a bass player as well. I think you're right. I don't think he evolves as a piano player in the last 50 years or as a drummer in the last 50 years. But there certainly was a good 10 years. I'd say his bass evolution even went into the Wings period when he kind of breaks out the Rickenbacker in the mid-70s. He's still doing fantastic stuff on his bass. Would you think they are equal as instrumentalists on their key instrument?
I think what surprised me, very pleasantly surprised me, when the 2009 remasters came out and I was listening to Please Please Me, which is an album that every time I go back to it, I forget how good that record is.
There's a great podcast on it.
The bass playing is superb on that. I mean, just amazing. Yeah. Again, very, very up in the new mix. But it's great. I mean, it's
elbowing the faders.
it's fantastic. So his bass playing was always great, and I think that comes from being, if not forced, but sort of encouraged as a guitar player to move, put the guitar down and pick up the bass, you know, because George at that point said, well, I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
So he became the bass player by default, but he's.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A melodic guitar player, and he brings that facility to the bass. Yeah. And it was a new way of playing the bass, I suppose, at that time. You don't have that. This is one of the criticisms that that George Martin has on the very first session, is that Paul and Ringo aren't locking in the way a traditional bass and drum setup would be. And it took him sort of a session to realize, oh, this is a different
they're
a different approach. Paul is really approaching it from a melodic perspective, and I think that's fine. I I don't think he values his own talent in one sense, because he doesn't work at it.
He has this odd thing, this fear of, like, particularly Paul's fear of not wanting to learn how to read music.
Yeah.
Which I remember kind of in the late 80s when he was doing his Elvis Costello collaborations. It's at that point that Costello did go off to learn how to read music and to score and to sight read and all that kind of stuff. And that sent him off on a different trajectory, whereas Paul is almost afraid sometimes to...
Yeah, if you don't lift the curtain, don't spoil the magic. But I think the flip side of that is sometimes you get from Paul, well, I'm Paul McCartney, I have this gift, this'll do.
Yeah.
So having said, you know, he doesn't value his talent in the sense that he doesn't feel the need to work on it or to curate this talent. And I mean, I would also say as a vocalist, superb vocalist, but he doesn't take care of his voice. He doesn't look after his voice. You know, the trope is he does two and a half hour shows and prides himself on not taking a sip of water.
Yeah.
Well, like, perhaps
look at me.
Yeah. Well, perhaps if he took a sip of water, he could still hit those notes for Maybe I'm Amazed. You know, he could, but he has a sort of a disregard, and that's the flip side. I think
I think it's part of him protecting himself at the same time as well. George, actually, I'm just noting, George also is a good bass player. The Abbey Road box set, even though George doesn't remember playing bass on Abbey Road, his bass playing is on Abbey Road. Okay, well, look, in terms of musicianship, then, all those in favor of George say George.
Oh,
hold on. All those. Okay, so we're going to put it to the crowd. All musicianship. hello, wake up. All those in favor of George say George. All those in favor of Paul say Paul.
Paul.
Oh my gosh, I thought George was going to get that one. So that's one in the round for Paul. I've got to get this bell back to ask the family or call my bluff.
Call my bluff.
Yes. Ah. Round four, we're going to look at solo careers.
Okay.
Ooh, ripple. Solo careers. I think that if John, Paul, George and Ringo, if you... kind of, I know it's impossible to imagine, but if they'd never been in the Beatles, if they were four guys starting solo careers in 1970 without the expectation of the Beatles, I think only Paul's career would have gone the distance. And, you know, I think he would have had sort of an Elton John type trajectory of a purple patch of albums in the 70s and then a long tail of albums that kind of slightly aren't quite as great, but a good showman and all that kind of stuff.
So you're just describing Paul's solo career.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to imagine myself not liking Paul. It's really hard. But I don't think the other solo careers, I think if you look at just the solo careers, not the Beatles careers, I think Paul's the winner, surely.
It's almost impossible to imagine, I think, any of the four of them having a solo career if they weren't launching off the platform of the Beatles.
Even this week, Ringo has gone into the charts at 99 with his new album, What's My Name? And it has its charms. His name's Ringo.
Yeah. You know?
But the only reason that album has even gotten to 99 is because he's Ringo from the Beatles.
Yes.
And so even that that kind of starshine is still...
And do you think Egypt Station?
Well, the number one album, Egypt Station, number two in the UK.
Yeah.
Well, I think Egypt Station's a fine album.
Good.
should I ring the bell for Egypt Station? All those in favor of Egypt Station? Yeah, okay, there you go. Okay, so you think the four of them...
I think it's very difficult to imagine... any of them having a solo career. You know, Paul, you know, what would his career be? You know, in the early 70s, he'd have been 30. I mean, are you sort of saying, well, could he have had a solo career in 62, 63? No. Could in 1970? Elton John is probably a good comparison. If Paul was kind of, you know, playing keyboards for some band and then struck out on his own as a singer-songwriter. Probably, but he delivers Wildlife. He doesn't get on a second. He doesn't get another chance if he's on his solo career. He doesn't get a year to make Red Rose Speedway. So, but
you kind of look at those albums at those times. Emmett Rhodes and all those.
Yeah, but this is what I'm saying. This is an impossible scenario to imagine. So I don't accept the I don't recognize the court on this one.
Okay, so but if your house was on fire, whose solo discography would you grab?
George's. It's easier to carry.
That is true.
Yeah, bring the bell.
You're only grabbing one of them. You know what I mean. Yeah? No?
No.
Don't you think All Things Must Pass does the heavy lifting?
Yes.
George's solo?
Yes. Yeah, discovery? I think it does. And again, tying back to, you know, everyone knows that a good portion of the songs that appear on All Things Must Pass date back as far as 1966. Mm. So isn't it a pity? Art of Dying were written in 1966. And, you know, these are fantastic songs that the Beatles, we're going to pass on those. All Things Must Pass, no, don't care for that. They, you know, one of the most dispiriting things in listening to the Let It Be outtakes, the Get Back sessions, is the disinterest whenever George produces All Things Must Pass.
And yeah, when you listen to the All Things Must Pass bootlegs, like for them to be floating away and to not nail it is so frustrating.
But you know, Lennon in particular is just absolutely not interested.
But is some of that force of personality though? Like George should have just, you know, he always.
But I think it is that. I think he in the business tape from September 1969, which has got a lot of press recently. George is actually saying, well, you know, yeah, I've had these songs for ages, but, you know, if people aren't interested, I'm just not going to push for this. So, but I agree, All Things Must Pass does the heavy lifting on George's career.
And I'd even say a third of All Things Must Pass is not listened to regularly.
It is in my house.
Is it? Okay.
But
everyone like Apple Jam? No? Okay.
So All Things Must Pass, I think, is genuinely all sort of partisan feeling apart. I think All Things Must Pass is probably the best Beatles solo album.
It is an extraordinary album.
I mentioned this previously, that I think it's a very conscious stepping away from the Beatles. So I think Paul, John, Ringo, they're all happy in those early 70s days to trade musically on the legacy of the Beatles. George is striking out on his own, not only by producing this expensively packaged disc, but also the sound is moving away from the Beatles. What happens then is the follow-up the next year doesn't happen, because he spends the entire year, or the bulk of the year, and the beginning of 72 is the concert for Bangladesh, which is something we maybe come on to as well. So, but undoubtedly that halts his career. It breaks the momentum. And then when Living in the Material World comes along in 1973, it's a sort of All Things Must Pass light.
Mm.
But the single, Give Me Love, Give Me Peace on Earth, that's a number one single, both sides of the Atlantic. Then the follow-up single is Don't Make Me Wait Too Long, which George stops because someone said to him it's quite Beatly,
right.
so he stops that. So I think,
but he's shooting himself in the foot. This goes back to point one, where he's being anti-Beatles for the sake of being anti-Beatles.
Well, I don't know. I genuinely think that by the time he gets All Things Must Pass out of his system, by the time he gets the concert for Bangladesh, I think George's ambition is almost sort of satisfied at that point.
Mm.
You know, you don't get any sense in his subsequent career that he's chasing a hit single, that he's, you know, he's not out there touring, he's not writing singles in between albums, he's not chasing chart success, he's not chasing money, he's not doing all the things that Paul is doing at that point, trying to reestablish a band. George realizes, I think, he's never going to be anything but Beatle George. He doesn't want to be Beatle George. He doesn't want to be in another band. Paul never accepts that he can't be in a band.
Yeah. You know, but why is he putting out those records in the late 70s? Like, well, he is trying. Like, he wouldn't have, you know, he eventually gets a massive hit record.
In 87?
In 87.
Yeah, I think, but he sort of, after Lennon's death, there is a sort of complete pause until 87 when he comes back. But then having got that,
Yeah, he doesn't capitalize.
He doesn't capitalize on that at all. Whereas I think if it was Paul,
apart from the Wilburys,
yeah. But if Paul was suddenly doing, you know, Paul would be saying, "Well, this is a springboard. We're going to organize an American tour. We're going to have a tie-in concert video. We're going to do this. We're going to do that." Paul has that ambition.
87 was the year Paul needed to have a Got My Mind Set on You type smash.
Well, I think I said to you before, I would take Got My Mind Set on You over Spies Like Us. It's a close call.
Is this in the House on Fire scenario?
Yeah. but you know, I genuinely think George is interested in other things. So music, I think, very rapidly becomes a kind of a side project. You know, he's out there going to Grand Prix and hanging out with Formula One. Then Life of Brian, Handmade Films, that comes along. What really gets him back in the mid-80s is Carl Perkins phoning him up and saying, I'm doing this show. So he goes along to that. And that kind of, you know, he's back in touch with Clapton. Dave Edmonds is there. Yeah.
That's the Jeff Lynne connection.
That's the Jeff Lynne connection. It's the one big mistake that George made was bringing Jeff Lynne. But I genuinely think... I admire that he... He satisfied his ambitions as a musician, and he recognized.
So you would think that George got the solo career he wanted.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you think Paul is happy with his solo career?
No, but I think it's an
why? Because he hasn't had a massive hit.
I think it's like Elton John. Mm-hmm. You know, so Elton John still gets singles delivered to his house every week. He reads the charts. He knows where his record is placed in Iceland, you know, on a particular day. He's still chasing that thing. And I think McCartney has that as well. And that's perfectly laudable. But he's got to realize he's not going to have a number one single.
No, not with your attitude, Stephen. I know.
But you know what I mean? I hesitate to say that there's something slightly unbecoming about that, but there's something slightly unbecoming about that.
Well, I think there's also something slightly charming about it. There's something slightly charming that he believes in the power of a pop song that reaches...
Charming.
Yeah.
You pronounce it, it's pronounced deluded.
There's something quaint. About him wanting to still write the ultimate pop song, whether it's even something like, Dance Tonight, which is kind of another one of those songs that kind of goes into the ether and you kind of think you've heard it before, but you haven't heard it before. And he just, you know, he's putting it out there. I think it's, you know, in terms of trying to find a thread back to the Beatles, you can say, well, you know, he believes in kind of the community of a pop song. Yeah. And I think the thing about Paul's work as a Beatle or as a solo artist is his work is the greatness of his work is dependent on it being popular. Like, he really appreciates the audience being added into his work. Whereas George was often quite insular in some of his solo stuff in particular.
Oh, I think that's right. I think Paul needs an audience. Mm. I mean, he needs that approval. Whereas I don't think George needed that.
Well, then in terms of solo careers, if you had to pick a favorite solo career, all those in favor of George say George. All those in favor of Paul say Paul.
Paul.
Now, in this scenario, if you choose Paul, you can't hear All Things Must Pass ever again. Okay.
Paul.
Okay. As you see, we still have it. So all those in favor of George say George.
George.
And all those in favor of Paul say Paul.
Paul.
Oh, man. Paul, I think. Is that a draw? Is that equal?
I think they're just lighter. they're not more numerous.
Next one, second last category is wider cultural impact and / legacy. And I suppose legacy, you know, it's different for George, sadly, because he passed away in 2001. But broadly speaking, I guess Paul's wider cultural legacy or impact is still quite tethered to the Beatles.
Yeah, and Mull of Kintyre.
Whereas George's is probably different.
I think so.
In what way, Stephen? I know this is
okay. Well, we talked about 1967, and that's really when the George, I think, for a brief period, maybe sort of 12, 14 months, took on a sort of a not a leadership role, but a sort of a guiding role. With the band in terms of Indian music, Indian philosophy. This came out of just picking up a sitar on the set of Help. But he goes along to a lecture by Maharishi. So he then gets into meditation. So then the rest of the band get into meditation, and you get all of the publicity attendant upon, yeah, the Beatles are going to hang out with this guy. There must be something. Mm-hmm. You look at where Transcendental Meditation sat in 1966, where it sat in 1968, and where it is today.
So it's down the road in Abbey Street.
So you look at outside the musical context. So let's look at that first of all. So in terms of cultural impact, all of those sort of Eastern influences, and whether that's meditation or whether that's yoga or whether that's vegetarianism, all of those things kind of start and are promoted really by the Beatles in 1967. You have the Beach Boys on board. Donovan, he doesn't like to talk about it, but he gets on board with that, and it really ripples out from that, because the Beatles are the cultural leaders, and for a time in 1967, George is guiding the Beatles. He is the first one to suddenly decide acid isn't the way to enlightenment. So he decided, that's pretty early on in 67. So he's off, he goes to San Francisco, he kind of looks and thinks this isn't the beautiful people. These are kind of, you know, sad drug addicts. And so he backs away from that. John is you know, ingesting acid for breakfast. Paul takes it twice and gives a press conference about it to make himself seem more interesting than he actually was.
He's just cutting to the chase.
But seriously, all of those kind of cultural influences that ripple down today, and whether that extends to, you know, George gets the Hare Krishnas in the charts. I mean, they have a top 10 UK singles.
Yes.
Then he decides, he gets prevailed upon by Ravi Shankar to get involved in the concert for Bangladesh. Mm. And if nothing else, in terms of the actual benefit and the cash and the money and the awareness that is raised, you suddenly have a number one album which contains an entire side of Indian classical music. It's in everyone's home. And again, this builds on the fact that when he is asked in 1967, and I made a joke about this earlier, so he and Paul McCartney are both asked to do soundtracks. Paul writes a little 3-minute melody for Love in the Open Air, which George Martin then works up into an entire score, and Paul gets the credit for a full score. George does Wonderwall. So he immediately goes off. He gets Eric Clapton. He gets Peter Tork. He gets the Remo 5. He gets all these people involved. He writes a score. And Indian music is involved. So this is the beginning of world music. Mm. He follows that through with producing records by Ravi Shankar. He does that tour in 74. Where he has Ravi Shankar, he's got Billy Preston. We were talking before, this is a kind of little template for the Graceland, you know, where you get these multicultural roadshow. And I think all of that is just that ripples out culturally. And that's even before we kind of get on to things like films. But I'll give you a chance. What has Paul done?
Well, he
formed that school in Liverpool.
He did. I was going to say, he really worked wonders for Rupert the Bear.
Yeah.
But he also, well, I suppose that we'll come back to the Lipa school in a sec. I mean, you're right. I think in 2019, there are certain things we take for granted, like things like yoga classes and granola. Yeah. I all go back to the late 60s. And, you know, I think George was at the forefront of some of that stuff, as well as these other things in the ether at that time, like the, you know, Earthrise picture and the Whole Foods catalog. And there was kind of a certain cultural, I don't want to say business side, that came out of the hippie evolution, but there was a lot of ideas that they came out of. I know we were talking once about that in that book about the Beatles and the history of drug culture, about when
Riding So High,
when they started, they had a party one day and George meets Derek Taylor and he gives him a big hug, and they're like, well, people didn't hug, so the Beatles invented hugging. So there's a certain kind of cultural change that, you know, that's quite normal now. Well, yeah, I think you're right. I don't think Paul...
I hope people are taking note of how many times you're saying you're right.
Paul certainly didn't have the same interest in thinking outside of, you know, Alley song structures.
No. And I think this is, you know, it's a different career path. Yeah. And Paul, he's very driven, and he's driven by that ambition to have the next hit single. He needs that kind of approval.
Well, there's a ripple effect from a song like My Sweet Lord, and I also Imagine.
Yes.
That I don't really can think of anything similar in Paul's solo.
Well, you've got Freedom and the Concert for New York. And everyone should go to YouTube and look at that little clip of him explaining to Eric Clapton that he's written a new song. I recommend that to
everyone. The song Freedom is better if you replace it with the word Sweden.
Sweden, okay.
In terms of philanthropy, Paul has, I think, his greatest gift is probably the Lippa School in terms of his cultural impact. And I think that's it's very emblematic of the man because it's totally pragmatic.
And about Paul.
And useful. Well, I think it is somewhere generally where he can specifically give his skill set. It's his old school. It's his old school, so he knows the area. He's got lots of money. He's in showbiz, so he can make some calls. Did you ever see the handwritten letter he sent to Prince?
Yes.
We'll try and put that up on Twitter. He wrote a handwritten letter to Prince from Soho Square to Paul asking him for money for Lippa.
Why did he need to ask Prince for money? He could write the check.
Yes, but he can. You know,
so two things. Whenever the concert for Bangladesh, there was an issue with the lawyers. Not George's fault. It was the lawyers. They didn't set the charity up correctly. So suddenly there was a tax bill.
Yes.
Of £1 million. Mm-hmm. That was going to come directly out. The money was going to come out of the funds that were going to Bangladesh. So George writes a check out of his own pocket for £1 million.
Yeah.
He didn't write a letter to Prince. He didn't write a letter to Prince.
He did concerts, I guess, for one thing, and he funded an awful lot of things in the background.
So the whole concert for Bangladesh setup really leads directly is the template for Live Aid.
Yeah.
And Geldof gets in touch with George to discuss the pitfalls of this. And also, and I can't decide if this is a story against George or against Paul, he says to George, you know, we're going to do this. And Paul's going to play Let It Be, and he'd quite like you to come and play on that. And George says, well, he didn't want me to play on it in 1970, so why would I play on it now? So, but the whole sort of concept of rock stars doing something, and interestingly, Lennon picks up on this, and he does the one-to-one concert in New York. So
and
suddenly,
this
suddenly becomes a thing.
I think, and we haven't even touched upon George's legacy as a movie producer.
Yeah.
I know
it's hard to top Give My Regards to Broad Street, but
it is. It's one of film, but or Nuns on the Run.
Yeah.
I guess the thing is, you could probably say, is Paul's legacy the same as the Beatles' legacy, and is George's legacy perhaps different to the Beatles' legacy?
I think that's absolutely where I would be coming from. Paul's legacy is inextricably linked to the Beatles. I think George's legacy less so.
Okay. So in terms of legacy and wider cultural impact, all those in favor of George say George.
George.
All those in favor of Paul say Paul. You're right. I think that's overwhelmingly for George there. So we're going into the last and final discussion round, which is a bit of a tricky one, and we mightn't hang on it too long, but it's personal. Personal lives, personal existence, George and Paul. And how they...
We have to bear in mind the age group of the audience.
There are children in the audience here, so we're going to not say anything untoward. Here's a question that I've often pondered. Who are Paul's friends? Like, we kind of know...
Sorry, that was my answer.
Yeah.
Was...
But I find it interesting that we know George would have friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jackie Stewart or Eric Idle or all the rest. I've never really, as much as I love Paul and read a lot about him, I don't really have a sense of outside of his family. And my God, you know, he's a great family man. I don't have any sense of who his friends are.
No, I think that I think this is again for me. This is integral to Paul's personality. It's all about Paul, really.
Yeah,
No, but seriously, if you watch the Material World documentary, one of the things that is most striking about that is the emotion with which people like Ray Cooper,
yes,
Jackie Stewart, the emotion with which they talk about George and his death and the effect that it had on them. And the fact that, as you say, he has friends, genuine friends,
yeah,
in the world of movies, in the world of music, and Formula One. You know, but I think he has a collaborative personality.
Mm.
Paul, I think, doesn't. I think completely different approach that comes out in their work, but I think it's a reflection of their personality.
Paul could never do a traveling wilderness.
No. I mean, I think, you know, Paul spent 1971 to 1979 trying to be in a band, trying to recreate that sense of camaraderie of being in a little van, traveling up and down the M1, you know, with Wings, but he couldn't do it because he's Paul McCartney. And at the end of the day, he's calling the shots.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's just to do with the fact that he's Beatle Paul. I think he is a man that needs to be in charge, where George, I think, is he had the sense to realize that if he wanted to be in a band again, it was going to have to be in a band with the likes of Roy Orbison, Bob Dylan. It was going to have to be that type of band. It couldn't just be four musicians that would come along and
Holly and Juba.
It's not going to be like that. So I think there is that sort of collaborative thing. And again, I think what I would take out of everything that Paul does is that Paul falls out with everyone in the end.
And in the end.
Yeah.
The friends you
lose are the friends you had.
Don't,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, he you know, I'm tempted to say, you know, I'm not a great one for what ifs, but what if in 1969 and 1970, if whenever Spector had produced or presented the finished tape of Let It Be, and you know, he put strings on I Me Mine, and he rearranged that. If Paul had just kind of gone, well, it's not what I would have done, but, you know, I suppose let's move on to the next album. But he has a complete hissy fit.
Mm.
To this day, you know, you can't mention Phil Spector. He gets up, walks out of award ceremonies if you know.
Yeah, but you know Phil Spector's in jail, right?
Yeah, I'd heard that.
So Paul's radar was 100%.
Well, then let's Klein.
Okay.
No, I'm not saying that Klein was a saint or Klein was a good guy, but he was signed to a management contract. So it's fundamentally different from what he's done with the Stones. He's signed up to a management contract. And the big point of contention for Paul is he shouldn't be getting 20%.
Mm.
He should be getting 10%. We're the Beatles. He should be getting 10%. Well, he was getting 20% of the increased income. So what would the worst case scenario have been if Paul had just said, okay, we'll sign up with Klein?
Mm.
The contract came to an end in 1973. John, George, Ringo realized by that stage, well, you know, Klein's no saint, but John never actually fell out with him. He's still in touch with him after that. So worst case scenario, they have Klein bringing them in lots of money and they don't renew his contract in 1973. But it gets complete because it's not about Klein. It's not about Spector. For me, it's about control.
Well, there is a bit of that. I mean, but I think I know you're right in saying Klein was just a management contract. But I think you see how the 60s Stone catalog is managed now, and you just worry that he would have finagled his way
maybe,
in, that
maybe
he
so.
Could have undermined.
Maybe
that.
So. Say, I'm not arguing that Klein was a saint. I'm not arguing. I'm just saying it was an overreaction, and I think a lot of it is to do with this idea that, you know, not, you know, maybe he's motivated by the best of intentions. That, you know, and back to your original point, he was the one that was most in love with the Beatles. I mean, he had, and to that extent, he had the most to lose, I suppose. But it's the inability to compromise.
Yeah,
and I think that rolls out into you can't really name people that Paul has a close friendship with. You know, George is friendly with Eric Clapton that married his wife. You know.
Well, but that leads us into the second part of personal lives, which is family lives. And I don't know if anyone saw, it was repeated recently, the Eric Clapton Life in 12 Bars documentary. And you think, oh my God, Patty Boyd got a raw deal. You know, it's just a heartbreaking kind of mess. And, you know, it's kind of, you know, almost put, you know, biographically, it's a bit of a joke. Oh, he's my husband-in-law. Ha ha, I'm glad she didn't marry some jerk. But it's actually kind of nasty in parts.
Well, actually, what he says in that press conference about Clapton is that I'd rather she was with him than some other dope.
Oh, other?
Yeah. So I think it's a little bit... But I think it's testament to George's personality that he doesn't fall out with Clapton, or at least not for long. He doesn't fall out with Patty Boyd. There's some incredibly touching photographs of Patty Boyd, you know, in the final years of George's life, coming to visit him at Friar Park. He seems, you know, we know about his relationship with Ringo's wife, but he and Ringo are still friends. So he seems to have this ability to stay friendly with people even when these emotional upheavals take place.
The older I get, though, the more I realize how kind of extraordinary the Paul and Linda thing was, because I'm old enough to remember the grief that was thrown their way and that was thrown her way, and particularly in the early 90s tours, you know, the Mike solo Mike and ha 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 laughing at her. I'm like, oh my, really, what's the point of all of that? I would have to say that seems to be a very...
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I, in terms of Linda and her musicianship, and I mean, again, I feel sorry for the position that she was put in. You can argue that Paul shouldn't have put her in that position, but, you know, if anyone hasn't heard it, I would recommend people go out. I think it's on Spotify, her solo.
Oh, yeah, Wild Prairie.
That's a great little, you know, it's not earth-shattering, it's not going to change the world.
But. Well, I certainly think whenever, and I know I've said this before, Seaside Woman on Red Rose Speedway, when that comes on, it's just...
It's a great song. We differ on Red Rose Speedway. I don't think that song should be on the album, but I think it's a great song. I bought it when it came out as a single.
Yeah. Okay, so in terms of personal and family lives, all those in favor of George say George.
George.
All those in favor of Paul say Paul. I think overall it's a draw. It has to be a draw.
There's just one very loud person shouting for Paul.
When it comes down to it, do you have any closing statements on Paul versus George? Have I convinced you at all
Have you convinced me?
Yeah, you've convinced me about George is all right, really, isn't he? Yeah, I think that's fair enough to say.
Yeah, Paul, I think they're completely different personalities.
Yeah.
I kind of like George because he's the underdog. I think he's the kind of, you know, he got a raw deal. I also admire the way he was able to get past the Beatles and into that solo career. And also, we didn't touch on things like handmade films and things like that. One of the things that I really admire about George is his ability and his preparedness to work with other people, to help other people. So I had pages and pages of notes about Apple and Apple being really John and Paul set Apple up. But if you look at the producer credits, the whole thing about Apple helping other people and giving a creative outlet, and you have Billy Preston, Doris Troy, Derek and Lon Van Eaton, Badfinger, Ravi Shankar. George was the one that took on to do that. He formed his own record label, Dark Horse. If you haven't heard it, the first album by Splinter, Cost of Fine Town, is the single. That's virtually a George Harrison album. You know, he's all over that album. It's this ability to collaborate and to encourage and facilitate other people being creative. Handmade is a good example of that. Now, Paul does that as well. You know, again, the album, I think you and I both agree, is the McGear album, which reissued recently.
It's a superb thing.
Where, again, Paul is collaborating, but he's collaborating with his brother. And it's virtually a one-off exercise. I think they're completely different. George headed off in one direction, Paul in the other. And I think that split happened in and around 1966.
Well, George famously said, oh, you know, we gave our nervous systems. And I don't think any of us can imagine, you know, what it would have been like to have been one of the four of them and how you'd respond to it in any given way. And, you know, I think George was generous with his time. I think you're right. The McGear album is an extraordinary thing. It does give you an insight. I wish there'd been a McGear album every 7 or 8 years.
Yes.
Could just get...
it's an outlet for Paul.
If people listening
haven't heard it, you should go over here.
It's great.
Better than Wings.
But I think in Paul's defense, you know, he has... he has always strained to try and bring joy and do it as graciously as possible. And it's a heavy burden to wear. And, you know, he's not, we were also chatting earlier on about how Van Morrison does interviews. And he has never played that card, no, particularly. And even if you look at something like the James Corden Carpool Karaoke, there's a bit where he's walking through the streets and people are like basically touching the hem of his garment. And he just wears it well. And I think we take it for granted how difficult it must be to live a life like that. And I think he has done that quite well.
Yeah, I think so.
So look, you know, there can't be a winner in Paul versus George, can they? They were in the Beatles.
Yeah.
That's the whole point, that we'd be out of a job if we started shooting them down. So we love them both. For a live episode, we would like to thank everybody for coming along. Give yourselves all a big round of applause. And as per usual, we remain available in the usual spots on Twitter, at BeatlesPod, on Facebook. Just look for the Nothing Is Real group on Facebook and join us there. And if you feel inclined to leave any nice reviews where you get your podcasts, that'll be much appreciated. But for now, this is Nothing Is Real. My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we will see you all the next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.